The Supreme Court of the state of Wisconsin is now in session. Chief Justice Keishon Rogoczek presiding. Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Well, good morning, everyone. Looks like we have a room full today for a very interesting case. Veritas Steel versus Lunda Construction. Counsel, are you prepared to begin? Please, Bill. Okay, I'm going to stop you for just a minute because I'm not hearing you. So
it might not be on.
Is he on now? Try it again. Ah, perfect. Thank you very much.
It's not on.
Still not on.
Try again.
Not
I think on. It just went on.
Nope.
Well, she can see over there better than we can tell here.
Might just need to go up.
Yeah, he's definitely not on because it would come out of our speakers.
The black.
Well, the lights are not the problem. The problem is with the mic. Now he's got a red light. He needs a green light and a mic.
That was wonderful.
Thank you.
Just wonderful.
Oh, we'll get it squared away.
Brilliant.
See, I can hear you because you're right in front of me, but I don't think it's going into the screen.
Our system isn't very good, so that maybe this is...
You turn the lights on higher and you can hear better.
That's why I want to be with you.
So far this day.
Modern technology, right?
This is just a test for the new Marshall. That's all.
Right, that's right.
And she's enjoying it, I'm sure.
Is our sound guy any place around?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
But we'll need the lights to be working too before you head out.
Frozen. Can't even. Okay. Can't read.
Okay. Now we have to put him back on green. Let's wait till we get all set before you.
Fair enough.
Oh, that's much better. Thank you.
Exactly.
If you can move it to the side if it's in your face, that's fine. Yeah.
Okay,
are we good to go? Okay, please begin.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Paul Rattel. I represent Lunda Construction Company, and we're here today to discuss the purview and breadth and considerations for successor liability. We believe that the issue that's presented to this court is whether the equitable remedy of successor liability is available to the creditors of PDM, where, in this instance, Veritas's acquisition of PDM as a going concern for $22 million gives rise to a claim for successor liability. As we know from the underlying transaction that's at issue here, Atlas, through its various entities, acquired the secured debt of PDM for some $22 million. We also know from the documentation, the evidence in this case, that Veritas valued the assets that it acquired from PDM at over $62 million. We also know that as part of the acquisition of PDM, that a wholly owned subsidiary of the principal owner of Veritas, BFH Secured Lending, assigned the secured debt to Veritas, which was the basis upon which the strict foreclosure transaction was accomplished. And in exchange for that assignment, Veritas has agreed to repay BFH secured lending, the $22 million that was the investment, if you will, of Atlas to acquire the secured debt to put Atlas slash Veritas in the position to control the transaction, pursuant to which Veritas ended up with these assets of PDM. So what we have here is a situation where Atlas is not only getting paid back all the money that it advanced to acquire the secured debt, but also acquired assets that were well in excess of the secure the amount that it paid for the secured debt.
Why does that matter, counsel?
Excuse me?
Why does that matter? Did it receive compensation in excess of what it paid for the secured debt?
Well, I think that the issue that the court in Fish and in Tift and more recently in Springer raises is whether or not there was a bona fide arm's length transaction pursuant to which fair value was paid. And what we know is that Atlas's objective in this transaction was not to become the lender of PDM. They identified at the very outset of the transaction their intent to acquire the debt for as little as they possibly could for the express purpose of acquiring the company. They never expected the loan to be repaid. They never used the loan as a means of doing anything other than acquiring the company. And they leveraged their position as a secured lender, particularly when there was already in place at the time they acquired the debt a forbearance agreement, which indicated that PDM was in default of its obligations under its secured loan. And pursuant to that arrangement, it required that the parties, PDM, the sole owner of PDM, ASP PDM, the sole member, and related parties, the American Securities, for example, that they enter into a transaction support agreement pursuant to which these counterparties agreed to not interfere and to provide all the necessary consents that would lead to Veritas owning all of the assets of PDM for the purpose of continuing the operation.
So let's concentrate on the acquisition of the secured debt. That's your entry point, isn't it, for your claims?
It is a data entry point, Your Honor.
Right. So is there anything in the record that suggests that the secured debt was worth more?
I think there are a couple of things to bear in mind with regard to that. One of them is that the $22 million was identified by Atlas itself as the liquidation value of the company. The court will recall in its 2011 case, PNB Paribas, that was a Chapter 128 proceeding that was an assignment for benefit of creditors, where the holder of $58 million of secured debt had the opportunity through that process for it and the other parties in interest to pursue a process under Section 128.25(6) to value the secured debt. If that process had been pursued here, if that had been made available for the benefit of all the creditors, an opportunity would have been presented to the parties whereby the value of that secured debt would have been consistent with the liquidation value, which we knew was no more than $22 million.
All right, so now
I thought concerns was that you thought the assets were undervalued at the sale because the $22 million of purchase debt was used to buy approximately $80 million worth of assets. I thought that was one of your concerns.
No, Your Honor. We've acknowledged that the value that's been acknowledged by Veritas through its filing with the IRS was about $62 million. We also know through the...
But $62 million then rather than... $80 million.
Right. That's right, Your Honor.
Okay. I was looking back at the insurance policy, I think, that was taken. That was basically the number. Are all of these LLCs formed in
Delaware, or are any of them Wisconsin LLCs?
I believe that they're all Delaware LLCs, Your
Honor. Do any of them have shareholders?
They have members.
Members, okay.
Yes.
Do any of them have stock?
Just their membership interest, Your Honor. So the
is a membership interest stock?
Yes, Your Honor.
It is
the functional equivalent of stock. That's how a member has equity in the LLC.
Well, that's how they have equity, but you are sure it's a functional equivalent of stock?
There are some differences, I agree. One of the differences is that you have in quasi-corporate form what would in the past have been considered a partnership. But LLCs are created that provide certain tax benefits as a partner, including distributions and what have you. That's a little bit different than a corporation. But you know, then we get into a lot of technical issues with respect to sub-S corporations and how they're taxed by the IRS. But the bottom line point here is that if we're looking at stock as an equivalent of and as indicating what is equity, that is the way in which equity is exchanged and valued and dealt with in an LLC.
Who are the members of Veritas?
There is only one member of Veritas, and I believe it's BFH.
Okay, and who is the member of PDM Bridge?
The sole member of PDM Bridge was ASP PDM, which is an entity that was majority owned by American Securities.
Okay.
And why that is relevant, Your Honor, is when we're talking about a couple of different issues that crop out of the Court of Appeals decision that forms, which is one of the reasons that we're here today. The Court of Appeals upheld the summary judgment determination by the Circuit Court on the basis that the de facto merger and mere continuation exceptions to successor non-liability require evidence of identity of ownership common to seller and buyer. And it thought that the position that we were taking to establish that would result in a new direction based on the based on Fish and then its earlier this court's earlier decision in Tift. Our position is that there is no new direction that we're seeking here, and that we believe that Fish correctly clarified the ruling in Tift by identifying two different means of identity of interest between the predecessor and successor corporation, the seller and the buyer of the assets, if you will. And what they identified was identity of ownership and identity of management and control. One of the reasons that identity of management and control became relevant is when you look at the TIF decision, it's clear that the justices had very different understandings of the underlying facts in that case. The majority viewed the metamorphosis of the sole proprietorship in TIFT to not involve the sale of or saw that as ending in a sale of stock. The dissent, relying on the factual findings of the trial court, said no, there was a sale of assets at the end, and that Tester Corporation, the party that ended up with those assets, acquired them through an asset sale. So you have a conflict within the decision itself as to what are the underlying facts.
But the decision was based on the final transaction being a stock purchase, correct?
Well, that's where the distinction, factual distinction, arises. But I go
yeah,
to...
I don't think we're interested in the facts of TIFT as far as it creates a dissonance between the majority opinion and the dissent. It's just a question of what was the rationale, right?
Right.
And the majority rationale was based on that it was a stock transfer.
Not really, Your Honor, with all due respect. What the TIFT court was dealing with is, here you have a guy by the name of Vernon Nedland, who is a sole proprietor, and then he ends up combining his operation with Woodrow Weiberg at one point, and then Nedland is out of the picture at some point, and the entity that results in the transaction with Tester Corporation, whether it's a sale of assets or a sale of stock, does not involve Vernon Nedland at all. And so the question becomes for the court, how do I create a path from Vernon Nedland, who's no longer with the company, and the Tester Corporation, which ended up with the assets? There are two different ways in which the court, and I think this is why Fish dealt with it in these two ways, is with continuity of ownership or continuity of management and control. Fish sat down and looked at the facts in that case, recognizing that the court didn't really describe in great detail, the court in Tift, did not describe in great detail what they meant by identity.
So, counsel, let me just make sure that we have a good understanding of the majority's
Justice
analysis.
Justice Kelly, excuse me, but I'm having trouble hearing you.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Maybe speak more into your microphone.
Yes.
Thank you.
Let's make sure we have a good understanding of the court's understanding of the facts in Tift so that we can properly deal with their reasoning. So that started with a sole proprietorship, right?
Correct.
And then there was a partnership.
Yes.
And then that partnership turned into a corporation.
Correct.
And then ultimately there was a stock transfer between Tester Corporation and Forge King Industries. Yes?
That's what the majority suggests.
Okay.
And the dissent says otherwise.
Right.
Correct.
Yep. And that's what its rationale was based on, that understanding of how, whether or not that's actually true. That was the court's understanding of how the metamorphosis occurred.
Yeah. Correct. Okay. Correct. And as I say, from the standpoint of Fish and looking at the TIF decision, they recognize that continuity of ownership alone couldn't explain the result in TIF, which is why they had to go to continuity of management and control. And the position that we're taking is that is an alternative means by which successor liability can be established.
Counsel, if this court doesn't agree with the proposition of these other means, if we do read TIFT or an IGL and Fish as having continuity of ownership as a theme, are there still factual questions that you would seek? Would you agree or concede at that point that if we rejected maybe the gloss on the test that you're asking us to adopt, do you still believe summary judgment was appropriate, or would you concede that summary judgment would be appropriate using that test?
Your Honor, I would say that there are still issues, and the issues come down to the question of identity of ownership or continuity of ownership. And the question that's let's just say this court finds that identity of ownership and identity of management and control are virtually synonymous. It's just two different ways of saying the same thing. I don't believe that's the case based upon the analysis in Fish and other cases that have looked at the issues of successor liability. I believe that the Wisconsin courts have more flexibility because of the underlying concern of identifying whether or not the entity that survives the transaction is the functional equivalent of the predecessor. But I would say with regard to identity of ownership, if we were to assume that they're synonymous, our argument would be that the statute, Wisconsin statutes 180.1101C2, which speaks to how a merger can occur, and of course we know under Wisconsin statutes that if there's a merger, that the successor company is liable for the obligations of the predecessor company, and that merger can occur through an exchange in which the acquiring company provides an obligation.
This isn't a merger, right? Under the statutes?
I would argue that it is a merger under the statutes, Your Honor, because what happened here is that the sole owner of PDM had obligations under $7.9 million of letters of credit,
Maybe I can back up and start from my idea of the beginning here. The ordinary rule is that there would not be successor liability, right? Except if they assume it and there's the traditional merger and there's documentation and
correct
assumption, right?
That's right.
So we don't have that automatic document. Otherwise, you wouldn't be here.
Correct.
Right? Okay. Yes. So now you're saying the ordinary rule of no successor liability does not apply. Thus, there must be an exception to the ordinary rule, right?
Correct.
And then when I look through these cases and I look at the ordinary rule and the exceptions to the ordinary rule, what strikes me is that they all involve this flavor of fraud.
Yes.
Right? So I am trying to reconcile, in part, whether you've waived that argument regarding fraud, because I think that's something that's come up. I also want to have you help me with this, because when I start looking at these cases, I put on my trial judge hat, right? And part of that tells me, is this a motion to dismiss? No, because enough was alleged in the complaint to probably get it by a motion to dismiss. Then we get to the next stage. Are we at a summary judgment stage? And at summary judgment stage, when they say, you haven't done enough to prove this exception to the ordinary rule, then we get into, are there material issues of fact such that summary judgment should not survive? So I'm just, in my mind, this is how I walk through how this goes. So when I get to that point where I'm wondering what the genuine issues of material fact are such that summary judgment was not properly granted, I need you to point to me the kind of fraudulent activity that occurred, or the deceptive activity, or the things that have been sufficiently put at issue here such that we have a case that goes beyond summary judgment, and point those to me in the record. Because otherwise what we have is anytime someone buys up assets, they're going to go to trial on that, because some creditor is going to say, hey, I didn't get my fair share, and that was deceptive to me. And similar people are involved, and they kind of dealt with each other, and they knew each other, and there was enough there that I should get a trial. Well, certainly we're not going to have trials in every single case where someone buys up something from a company that's in debt. So walk me through what it is that puts this into that unique category that's an exception to the ordinary rule, and what the facts are that need to be tried.
Your Honor, if I could just clarify a couple of points. One of them is that de facto merger and mere continuation don't require fraud. But it's true that, for example, the Gallenberg decision, which is a federal court decision, which the court was asked to consider continuity of control between the seller and the purchaser.
So anytime you have people who are the same, so if you have a group that forms one entity, a corporate entity for one building, and they form another corporate entity for another building and another corporate entity for another business deal, if they ever buy out the other one, that's going to be automatic. You're going to trial to any creditor of the first corp. Why even bother forming multiple corporations then if every corporation is going to be on the hook? See what I mean? You need to walk me through what makes this different than that, because I think people do that all the time in business. They form separate corporate entities for a reason.
No, you have a couple of different things. Here, one of the objectives was for Atlas to cleanse PDM of obligations of PDM, such as those owed to Lunda. They entered into the transaction for that express purpose. They acquired the debt for the express purpose of buying assets that they knew had value that exceeded what the secured lenders were willing to take to transfer the secured debt. Then they leveraged their position.
And why does
so? How's that different? I'm sorry.
Yeah, no,
just, how's that different than a good business deal?
Then the which I'm
when you acquire a company for less than it's worth, that's often called a good business deal. So what makes it that different thing, such that it's an exception to the ordinary rule?
Well, I would say, Your Honor, that you know, the court's ruling with regard to Springer, and let me just jump to that real quickly. In the Springer decision, the court considered a earlier decision in Oklahoma, Avery versus Safeway Cab Transfer Storage Company. And in that earlier Oklahoma decision, that court said, but where the transfer of assets strips a debtor corporation of all its assets and disables the corporation from earning money to pay its debts, thus leaving creditors and holders of claims no resources to which they may look for the payment of their due, the net result is, in effect, a fraud.
Can I take you back to what I think you were trying to ask, is away from the fraudulent piece of this, which you seem to be going to, even though you said that it's not about the de facto merger and mere continuation exceptions do not involve fraud.
Correct.
So you keep taking us back to this isn't fair, this isn't fair.
Right.
So away from that, looking at the test you want to apply, what I think Justice Ziegler is asking is what are the facts
right.
that you think support de facto merger and mere continuations that aren't already in the record? There's a million facts in this record. So what is it? Where's the genuine issue of material fact? We know who the owners are. We know they're not the same. We know that there's no stock transfer. I mean, we know these things. So what exactly are you trying to what would you do if this went back on summary judgment?
Well, one of the issues that I would relate to is the fact that under Wisconsin statutes, and again, I refer the court to 180.110.12C.
It's not a statutory merger, so go away from that to answer my question, because if we send it back, we're not sending it back for that. We'd be sending it back because we were agreeing with you.
There are genuine issues of material facts.
About identity of ownership and identity of management and control. Those are the pieces you're saying are part of this de facto merger and mere continuation exception. Go away from the statute. This is not a statutory merger. What are the facts?
If I can, Your Honor, the fact is that that where the sole owner of an organization is provided an obligation by the acquiring company, which occurred here. Here's what happened. Veritas agreed to, in effect, indemnify the owner of PDM of its liability under $7.9 million of letters of credit. When we talk about continuity of ownership, my view is, and what I'm proposing to this court, is that continuity of ownership isn't limited to a sale of an interest in the seller with an interest in the buyer, that that Wisconsin statutes and the merger. Look, TIFT starts with the proposition that we're following corporate formalities and establishing successor liability. My point would be that this transaction is one of a number of different items of evidence that we would submit to prove identity of ownership, even assuming that identity of ownership is synonymous with identity of management and control, which we believe it is.
Okay,
not.
Following that along, isn't all of that in the record? Just the way you perceive it, you want us to agree with you that looking at the facts in the record, that this is continuity of ownership. But the question I'm asking is there some dispute about the facts? And I think actually Justice Hagedorn started this, Justice Ziegler continued it, and I'm asking you, is there a genuine issue of material fact, regardless of whether we accept your argument or not? And I think, can he answer?
Yeah.
Okay.
And my answer is very simply, we can agree on a lot of the individual circumstances, but the question becomes, what are the reasonable inferences that can be drawn from these facts and circumstances?
So the answer is no. All the facts are here. You're drawing different inferences.
Correct.
Okay.
That's right.
Thank you.
That's right. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yep. That's correct. And as a result, the inferences that we would ask the court to draw on remand would be whether or not identity of ownership is satisfied by, among other reasons, this acquisition. I see that my time is up.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much.
May it please go to Michael Leffel from Foley and Lardner. I'm just introducing my co-counsel, Richard Mancino, who's been admitted pro hoc vice from Wilkie, Farr, and Gallagher, who will be handling the argument for respondents.
Very good. And I could hardly understand you, so when you speak,
Please try to pick up whether the mic is picking you up. I'm sorry that we're having trouble.
Well,
that's
yes,
fine.
Okay.
I knew what you were saying, so it was okay. But
I thought what I was saying would be powerfully persuasive, but
it was. You won.
Motion denied.
Okay.
I know it's not convenient to have to hold the goofy mic, but it looks like where we are today.
May it please the court, and thank you for the privilege of appearing before you this morning. This court is being asked by an unsecured contract creditor who had no prospect of recovering on its debt to rewrite settled Wisconsin law on the two key exceptions to the general rule of non-liability in asset transfers.
So is identity of ownership enough to get you to trial? And is there identity of ownership here?
Identity of ownership, Justice Siegler, is the key element under settled Wisconsin law. And there's no disputed fact. There's no dispute that it's not present here. I can point you to Lunda's brief on appeal on page 3. They wrote, the Veritas PDM transaction did not include proof that Veritas and PDM had common shareholder, members, or an exchange of membership interests. That's conclusive on the absence of continuity of ownership in this case. And there was no stock transfer, so neither the de facto merger nor the mere continuation
exceptions. Does it matter that there might have been a continuity of ownership of the debt, the secured debt? Does that matter at all?
I don't think that matters, but let me break that down, Chief Justice. The PDM secured debt ultimately had a face value of $750 million in principal and interest that was owed. That had been held by a syndication of lenders, the members of which changed over time. And then ultimately, when PDM fell into a financial death spiral, it hired an investment banking firm to market the assets, to see if they could, if those assets were worth anything close to being able to pay off that secured debt. They reached out to 172 potential interested parties, one of whom was Atlas Holding Company, the ultimate parent of Veritas. Veritas, Atlas and Veritas made it very clear in response to Houlihan Lokey's overtures that, yes, they might be interested, but they'd be only interested in conducting an asset purchase or a UCC foreclosure or a debt purchase. And so ultimately, when they were the last person standing, they settled on, in negotiations with Houlihan Lokey representing PDM and PDM's owners, on a debt purchase. So they went into the distressed debt market, which is a robust market in this country, and were able to acquire the debt at a discount from face value. That discount from face value reflected the market's belief and understanding that PDM had no prospect of ever paying off its debt.
So, counsel, when we're talking about the purchase of the secured debt, the purchase price versus the face value amount, the only reason we're interested in that discrepancy is to see if there's any fraud involved. Is that right?
I think that would be the only reason.
Okay, so if we find that there's, if the record does not bear out that there's any potential fraud in the purchase of that discounted value, then after that, the analysis concentrates entirely on the amount of the face value of the debt. Is that correct?
Yes, exactly, okay. Justice Kelly. It's the face value here. A debtor does not get out from under the contractual obligation, and this is a central concept of secured debt, merely by virtue of the fact that it can't repay it and that debt's trading at a discount in the market. It's the face value that counts.
And is it undisputed that the face value of the debt exceeded the value of the assets acquired eventually?
It did. And at summary judgment, Circuit Judge Remington specifically asked counsel for Lunda whether there was any evidence that PDM's value was equal to or in excess of the face amount. And he quite rightly answered no, there was no such evidence.
I think the only thing that I could find was the insurance policy, which would have exceeded the face value of the debt.
Yeah, the insurance policy, of course, you know, puts in values for lost profits, for business interruption. And that was one of the things that allowed Lunda to survive the motion to dismiss. But again, quite properly, Lunda abandoned that when it came down to putting forward any facts to defend against summary judgment. So that was not in play at all, Your Honor. So if I can bring the court back to just the key undisputed facts that govern the result here. And I dare say, I think it's fairly simple. In light of the fact that continuity of ownership and stock transfer are the key elements that have to be present here but are not. So there's no evidence, none, of identity or continuity of ownership between the debtor, PDM, and the creditor, Veritas. And I've already given to the court Lunda's admission of that fact. Lunda was out of the money. Its unsecured debt sat behind $75 million, ultimately, of secured debt. And there is no evidence, again, none, that PDM's assets had enough value to fully satisfy its secured debt, whether that debt was held by Veritas or any other secured lender, and leave money over for unsecured creditors. So Lunda invites the court to abandon these well-understood legal principles, claiming that successor liability should be imposed where the asset purchaser shared no ownership with the seller. The asset purchaser acquired the assets in compliance with the Uniform Commercial Code's remedies. And remember, those remedies are, there are several remedies you can choose from. The parties picked the strict foreclosure remedy here.
But they picked that so they could dust the debt off the assets, right?
Well, that's precisely the purpose behind the general rule of non-liability. And
well, so that's why they use strict foreclosure. They wanted to be in control of the assets, but they wanted to dust the debt off, right?
Exactly right, and any subordinate interest as well, which is what a strict foreclosure accomplishes.
Counsel, you make the argument that the fraudulent transfer claim has been abandoned. Yet forfeiting or abandoning a claim does not preclude this court from taking up the issue, since forfeiture is a matter of judicial administration. Should we take up that issue?
With respect, Your Honor, no.
Okay.
And
why not?
Would you be amazed if he said yes?
And I'll move on to my next argument, if I may. No. As we pointed out in our brief, Lunda abandoned that argument at the circuit court level when it didn't pursue it on summary judgment, and then did not pursue it in any form at the Court of Appeals. And indeed, look at their appeal brief. They have, you know, a heading, successor liability, with two exceptions, the de facto merger and the mere continuation. And then another Roman numeral heading, Wisconsin Uniform Fraudulent Transfer Act. So what basically happened here, and I think that this court in Springer made that observation, is that oftentimes an unsecured creditor seeking to challenge an asset purchase will put all its chips on the Wisconsin Uniform Fraudulent Transfer Act instead of pursuing the fraud exception to successor liability. And I submit that's what happened here.
Counsel, I'm sorry, were you finished with your answer?
I was.
Yeah. Just getting back to this continuity of ownership piece, could you talk a little bit about two things? Number one, the relationship between stock transfer, when it's necessary and when it's not, in your view, under the doctrine, and maybe talk to us a little bit about why, this is a sort of equitable, understood as kind of an equitable exception sort of to the normal rule, why it is a continuity of ownership is so essential in this context.
Justice Hagedorn, let me take your second question first, if I may. The reason continuity of ownership is so essential is because it's the remedy that was devised to defend against the situation where an owner or owners of a company transfer the assets in order to get away from that company's indebtedness, but then transfer it to another company in which they retain ownership. And that way, they're gaming the system. And so that's contrary to the general principle that there should be non-liability in an asset purchase, but not where it's the same owner on both sides of the transaction. Therefore, that's why this court and courts in probably the majority of states have said continuity of ownership or a stock transfer is the key element.
Counsel, if you have these LLCs and they're not going to be transferring stock, and you have different members, so Veritas has one member, and PDM had another member, and they're all conglomerates, can't you just do whatever you want? Because you're never going to have an actual transfer of either a membership interest or a shareholder's interest.
Well, Your Honor, you can indeed transfer membership interests in an LLC.
Of course, but not when you have the kind of membership interest that you have set up in these LLCs. They're conglomerates. You told me the members come and go who were the members of the first company, the PDM Bridge Company.
No, I was speaking about the secured debt. That there were, secured lenders could, under the credit agreement, assign their interest. But with respect to the LLCs, whether you're talking about PDM, PDM had membership interests, and as Mr. Rattel pointed out, the sole member of that was ASP PDM, which was then owned by American Securities. Veritas has no connection whatsoever with those entities.
So its sole member is a made up other LLC that was made up to hold membership?
Yeah, it's another affiliate of Atlas called, it used to be Bridge Finance Holdings, now it's called BFH. So again, I take you back to the key undisputed fact. There is no continuity of ownership between PDM on the one hand and Veritas on the other hand. If I may spend a moment on Fish and Tift.
I'm sorry. Could you just to follow up? The other question that I asked was just about talking about the relationship between stock transfer and continuity of ownership. Is stock transfer always required? When is it not, in your view?
Some form of equity ownership, whether it's represented by stock or, say, a membership interest in an LLC, is required. And where that's absent, the mere continuation exception does not apply. And I think that's settled law. Now, Lunda is trying to create a, I would say, rather opaque replacement test for ownership continuity through its continuity of management and control. And it says that the TIFT court created a loophole through which it can now say that should be the controlling test here. Well, I thought I heard the court saying that TIFT really represents an application of the continuity of ownership test. The court there was looking to see whether there were common owners, albeit in the context of different business organizations and corporations. And that's what it was looking for. So it looked at, okay, who owned the sole proprietorship? Well, it was in the body of the sole proprietor, Mr. I think his name was Weigand. He transferred the assets to a partnership. Who owned that partnership? Well, it was the sole proprietor now wearing his partner hat, along with a second partner. They then transferred the assets into a corporation and became shareholders. So at every step, there was continuity of ownership there. So TIFT was not creating a new test. And this court in Fish was not endorsing a new test. It, in fact, said, look back at what happened in TIFT.
Are there any limits on the way in which a successor corporation may operate if there is not continuity of ownership?
Heard the beginning of your question,
okay.
Your Honor.
Are there any limits on around which a successor corporation can operate if there's not continuity of ownership? For example, here, Veritas Steel paid off some of the debts of PDM. They needed their suppliers. They weren't debts of the new corporation, but they paid them off. I mean, and I haven't, I'm sure, read everything that's involved in this record, but what I'm asking you is, are there any limits? So if the new corporation doesn't have continuity of ownership, but it operates and steps up to responsibilities of the former corporation, are there any limits, or can it just do that as long as there's no continuity of ownership?
Well, there's always limits to what you can do, because you have to abide by the law. But the general rule is the general rule for a reason, because it wants to promote the productive use of assets, particularly distressed assets. And so that's what happened here. And I think this court in the Columbia Propane case even observed that under the general rule, an asset purchaser can decide which liabilities it wants to assume and which it doesn't. And that's the general rule in operation. That's how it should operate. It makes sense. And here, the fact that Veritas acquired assets in the form of bridge fabrication facilities, extended employment offers to former PDM employees, and then invested capital into that new business so that it could maybe start a new independent company that could make profits for its new owners. That's the general rule of non-liability in action. That's the whole purpose of an asset purchase in general terms. Now, when you consider the policy argument or policy rationale that Lunda advances to support its new test, it boils down to basically the fact that under no circumstance would my debt have been paid because the assets of PDM were insufficient to pay off debt that was senior to me. There was no ownership continuity between the seller and the purchaser. But, you know, you should have pity on me. And it, in fact, kind of tries to suggest it's in the same boat as a product liability victim who is left without a remedy. Well, in fact, it's a sophisticated construction company that otherwise knows how to protect itself. It consciously did business with PDM, entered into a contract, which apparently had not been set forth in a writing, and failed to demand a surety performance bond. It could have helped itself. But I think, again, as this court in Springer said, the and I'm looking for my quote, the bare desire for a remedy, however, is an insufficient rationale for imposing liability on an entity that had no relationship with the culpable company until after the risk was created. And the record here, and again, there's no dispute, that Atlas and Veritas, my clients, were strangers to PDM Bridge until they got a phone call a few months before this transaction happened from Houlihan Lokey, the investment banker, saying, would you be interested in this opportunity? Well before them, Lunda had done business with PDM. Lunda had accused PDM of breaching the contract. My clients had nothing to do with that. So whatever policy rationale Lunda advances here doesn't warrant this court changing what until now has been settled law in Wisconsin. And I would also note that there's not a court in the Wisconsin jurisprudence that I'm aware of that has adopted or supports this continuity of control test. And the Gallenberg decision, which counsel mentioned, is probably a stark example of that, and that court rejected it. In that case, I mean, you had two individuals who actually managed the day-to-day affairs of the selling company, sat on its board of directors. They had a management agreement that gave them the right and obligation to manage the business. The company fell into distress. The bank holding the secured loan foreclosed and sold the assets to those same two individuals who formed a new company. And the argument there was, well, they weren't owners of that, of the selling company. They became owners of the purchasing company. Was control enough? And the court in Gallenberg said no, that there, in the absence of ownership continuity, based on this court's precedence, there's no successor liability. So that case is a good example of a court that rejects this control test, but that is not the test in this court's jurisprudence.
How about the IGL court case out of the Wisconsin Court of Appeals? Did that case too? Excuse me, I seem to have found a frog this morning. Did that case too reject identity and control?
It didn't apply it. In my reading of that case, it's an interesting case because you had nonprofit corporations, which by definition don't have shareholders who own it.
But they could have members.
Well,
right?
It had a director, mm-hmm. and he was the founding incorporator of the the predecessor entity. So he was a founder. He was, you know, in effect an owner of that. And then he was the founder and the director of the entity that acquired the assets. So I don't think that's an example of continuity of control as a test. It shows, rather, the flexibility in this court's rule that there has to be continuity of ownership. So you can look for continuity of ownership even where the corporate or the business forms might not be just a simple corporation.
Well, your test is some form of equity ownership, and the IGL case didn't involve an equitable ownership. Equity ownership.
Yes, that's right. It did not involve an equity ownership, but it had, you know, the founder and director.
They seem to talk more about management and control. Not they, I think it was Judge Fine that wrote for the Court of Appeals, so it would have been that branch of the Court of Appeals.
Well, I think it's better understood, Your Honor, and can be read in consonant with this court's decision in Fish, for the reasons that I mentioned. I see my time is waning. I'm not quite done. I don't think. But
you have 5 minutes yet.
Oh, okay. A word about the test that Lunda proposes. At the circuit court level, Lunda was invited to explain the parameters of this continuity of control and management test. What were the elements that would be put in front of a jury? And it was unable to do so. It basically said, well, we'll go with the ebb and flow of the proof. That's not a test. And there's no predictability, no certainty to an opaque, vague test like that. If you look at how in the briefing Lunda would apply the test here, it would take the normal activities of parties who are cooperating to effectuate a transaction, and in fact have undertaken, as the Uniform Commercial Code requires, to cooperate toward a strict foreclosure, and then work together to make that happen. Lunda would say those are liability-imposing actions. And I would say that that would certainly have a chilling effect to any lender or any company that engages in a non-hostile transaction with another party. And it would also have the sort of predictability in application that a lightning strike has. You would never know when your conduct stepped over the line or when it did not step over the line. And here, if you look at the things they point to, it's under an umbrella of a written agreement to cooperate toward a strict foreclosure, the parties, some employees of PDM, were assisting to the Atlas folks to set up Veritas. They, the PDM employees, were operating the day-to-day business of PDM. No one from Veritas stepped in and took that over. So as a sum up, Your Honors, I come back to some basic points. The first is Lunda really has no standing to complain about any of this because there never was a scenario under which they were going to get paid. They stood behind $75 million in secured debt. This company did not have a value anywhere close to paying that debt off, and that's undisputed in the record. And that was proven by the marketing effort that took place under the aegis of Houlihan Lokey. And as I noted, Lunda admitted that in the court below. Veritas went by the book. It followed the UCC's strict foreclosure guidelines, documented the transaction as the UCC requires, because it says if you're going to do a strict foreclosure, you've got to have a writing to do that. And it obtained the cooperation of PDM, which is another requirement of strict foreclosure. And then it did what it was obliged to do. It discharged $72 million of indebtedness. So it complied with the law, and there's no evidence to the contrary. And then last, coming back to one of the first points I made, there was no continuity of ownership. Again, Lunda admits that. Lunda can't win under this court's current law, the current law in Wisconsin on which all the parties here relied. So it wants you to change the rules. And I respectfully request that you decline that invitation and affirm the circuit court. Thank you, Your Honor. Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Counsel, one of the arguments that the respondents make is essentially an economic efficiency argument. Basically, if liability can be imposed after an asset sale like this, nobody would purchase distressed companies, jobs would end, doors would close. So in this case, we have a foreclosing creditor who obtains the assets, keeps the company going, saves jobs. Under either scenario, the unsecured creditors are not going to get paid, period. So why not apply the law in a way that promotes the economically efficient outcome?
I would submit, Your Honor, that where you have a situation where an entity like Veritas is grabbing tens of millions of dollars of value in relation to the monies that it is extended to acquire that to the exclusion of the unsecured creditors of PDM, that's not appropriate, that successor liability is in fact a legitimate area of consideration and of a remedy that should be available to creditors like Lunda. Counsel made the argument just a moment ago that there was no scenario under which the secured debt would be paid through this transaction. The facts are 100% to the contrary, Your Honor. The secured lenders accepted $22 million. The parties that were out the money, that were out the $72 million, accepted $22 million in satisfaction of their interest as secured lenders. So, you know, that statement is
counsel, that's not the transaction we're interested in, is it?
I believe it is, Your Honor. I believe that so here's the issue. The issue is, was the transaction that led to the strict foreclosure arrangement, was that a bona fide arm's-length transaction between a willing buyer and a willing seller? The answer to that is absolutely not.
All right, so let's camp on that for just a moment. You're not pursuing your claim under Wisconsin's Uniform Fraudulent Transfer Act. Is that correct?
Your Honor, the Court of Appeals had identified that there is an absolute defense to that claim where the transaction is done pursuant to a strict foreclosure. Now, that law has changed in other jurisdictions, but that's not the statute here.
Right. You've not presented any argument to us under that statutory provision. Is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
That's correct.
And with respect to the common law fraudulent transaction, have you waived that claim?
I don't believe we have, Your Honor, because at the trial court level as well as at the Court of Appeals level before the Springer case was decided, all the parties assumed that the fraudulent transaction exception was coextensive with the fraudulent transfer statutes. Springer made clear that they are not the same, and at no point did we ever waive or give up the right to assert the third exception.
But you didn't provide any you didn't provide any argument in response to the summary judgment motion that the common law fraudulent transaction exception should apply. Is that correct?
No, that's not correct, Your Honor. What we said was that the fraudulent transaction exception was coextensive with the fraudulent transfer. The court understood it that way. The court made the ruling that way, made a specific ruling with regard to fraudulent transaction at the trial level.
Are you asking us to remand this to the trial court so they can consider this under the common law fraudulent transaction claim?
If that's the inclination of this court, of course, that would be appropriate in light of this court's decision in Springer.
Can I just interject before your time is up? Sometimes I think it's helpful to weigh whether there's a genuine issue of material fact up against the elements of what's being alleged. Can you walk me through the elements of your claim?
Absolutely. So let's take de facto merger, for example. There's a continuity of business operations. I don't think there's any dispute of fact that Veritas continued the business operations of PDM. There's continuity of ownership. That's the big issue that we've been talking about here today and that we've briefed. Third, cessation of the seller's operation after the sale. That clearly occurred here. There's no dispute as to that. And four, assumption by the purchaser of the seller's obligations to the extent necessary to keep the business going. Also present. Now, there are other jurisdictions which weigh these elements and don't provide any priority of one over the other.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Obviously, this is a case we could have argued for a whole lot longer on both sides. Your briefs were very good and very helpful, and as were the. We're going to take a brief recess now so that our next group of lawyers can come. Next argument of the morning. We are adjourned.